www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The combination of poverty and urban heat leaves U.S. vulnerability to climate events extreme, says Sasha Bromsky, writer, in an article published under the heading, Record-breaking heat waves have arrived decades earlier than predicted. Stay tuned for more. The heat waves of 2021, which have pummeled western regions of the United States and Canada, have killed, at a minimum, hundreds of people. In British Columbia, authorities recorded a spike in death in the nearly 500 range after temperatures soared to near 120 degrees, and in both Oregon and Washington state, dozens more are known to have died. Yet those numbers, horrific as they are, do not tell the full story of the devastation caused by this summer's record-breaking temperatures, caused by climate catastrophe that, until recently, even the most pessimistic climatologists thought was still two or three decades out. Indeed, the mortality data showed that recent deaths were not simply a result of just one extreme heat event. There have already been a series of heat domes, a phenomenon in which extreme heat generated by warm ocean air is trapped under a high-pressure cap parked over the western part of the continent this summer, with more on the way. And the trend continues. Each of those domes will bring death in its wake, and each will compound the damage inflicted by previous heat events as vulnerable people fall prey to a lethal combination of heat, pollution, isolation, and a lack of access to air conditioners and cooling centers. Moreover, as the heat wave impacts accumulate, many will suffer cascading health consequences. This has already been seen in earlier extreme heat events around the world, perhaps most notoriously in Europe in 2003. Epidemiologists now estimate that a week-long heat wave spikes mortality on the continent by between 50,000 and more than 70,000 deaths. That's almost as many people dying per week of heat-related ailments in 2003 as died of COVID each week on the continent, at the height of the pandemic in 2020, when deaths in Europe peaked at about 40,000 per week. Awful as the recent numbers coming out of the western U.S. are, those preliminary numbers do not tell the full story of excess mortality, a story that takes time to fully investigate. Moreover, they do not tell the more intimate story of who is getting sick or dying, and of the disparate impact, too often ignored in the broader political conversation, of these increasingly devastating environmental cataclysms on poorer communities of color across the U.S. When it comes to heat waves and the violence they produce, we have this will not to know that makes it very difficult to act, explains Eric Klinsberg, a New York University professor of sociology and author of the 2002 book Heat Wave, about a lethal weather event in Chicago in the summer of 1995 that resulted in hundreds of isolated, mainly elderly residents dying. There is something existentially challenging about absorbing the reality of climate change, what it means for how we live, how we settle, how we organize our lives. The health risks of heat are hard for people to understand because they're not like fires or hurricanes or earthquakes, where everyone can recognize the heat. Heat doesn't feel scary to most Americans because we are one of the most air-conditioned, artificially cooled nations on Earth, so it's hard to generate political will to protect poor people in heat waves, unquote. Yet, of course, not everyone has access to air conditioning or even to homes in which air conditioning could be installed. While an estimated 87% of Americans do have some air conditioning, even if only a wall unit in their homes, that leaves 13% and a far higher percentage in poorer communities, particularly vulnerable during sudden temperature increases. A residential consumption survey from 2015 showed a direct correlation between household income level and availability of air conditioning. Nearly 3 in 4 households with income above $100,000 had central air conditioning, while barely half of the households with incomes of under $40,000 did. Of course, air conditioning is why necessary in large parts of the world as the planet heats up are hardly a cost-free panacea, since AC systems themselves feed into a vicious cycle of adding heat-generating pollutions into the atmosphere. And even for those who do have some air conditioning, recent studies have shown that poorer, non-white, urban neighborhoods across the U.S. with higher population densities, fewer shade trees, and historically less emphasis on efficient urban design experience far higher temperatures than do wealthier, more planned communities in the same cities. The class differences in the U.S. hold in big metropolitan areas and small towns alike, and the research shows that communities with a higher percentage of African American and Latino residents tend to have hotter temperatures than do whiter population centers. Because of the legacy of redlining, which relegated African American populations in particular to less desirable physical locations in cities, those districts tend to be more at risk of flooding or particulate pollution, and now of heat extremes because of global warming. Older people and socially isolated people also experience a highly disproportionate number of heat wave deaths, according to Klingsberg. In the coming years, Klingsberg fears the U.S. is uniquely ill-positioned to deal with the consequences of an escalating global warming crisis. We have a climate emergency, a racial justice emergency, and an inequality emergency, and a social infrastructure emergency, he argues, adding, we have to deal with the fact that there is grotesque poverty in the United States, and that cities are heat ovens. That combination of poverty and urban heat leaves U.S. vulnerability to climate events extreme.
We get people. Unsafe America. The
The United States is experiencing a surge of crime, which could catapult the issue to the top of the political agenda in the near future. A nationwide spike in shootings and murders has made the streets of America unsafer than before, but without much attention from authorities.
It was my middle child's birthday. He was turning 12. And later on that day, we were going to celebrate at home like we do. We were waiting for Wanye to come. When he didn't come, it was devastating.
Wanye had been killed in a drive-by shooting.
Hello, I'm your host Mila Javamadi. Welcome to We the People. In this episode, we try to get to the bottom of the recent spike in crime. We will ask, why is there so much violence in America today? What is the reason for the latest spike in shootings? And what should the government and the nation do to tackle the issue? Stay with us.
We've seen increases from last summer to this summer, in part because of the protests, in part because of the COVID stay at home, people coming out. And I believe there's a tension that has built up in all of the major urban areas that have been shut down.
2021 is on track to be America's deadliest year of gun violence. Data from Gun Violence Archive shows that the number of multiple victim shootings first spiked in April of 2020 and has stayed high ever since. The deadly pattern has continued this year. There have been 160 shootings from 1st of January to 26th of April 2021, in which four or more people were injured or killed, compared to just over 90 shooting incidents during the same period in 2020. And this year's total is nearly double the average for the same time period for every year since 2014. The number of shootings in some cities such as Chicago and New York has more than doubled over the past 2 years. Homicides are also occurring more often. Violence is raging across the United States in all sorts of demographics, from wealthy communities to poorer areas, and in towns and cities run by both Democrats and Republicans.
According to some estimates, major American cities saw a 33% rise in homicides last year. Other estimates put the figure at 25%, but what is for sure is that crime rates appear higher than what is considered usual. Our first guest today is Emilia Viano, president of the International Society of Criminology. Thank you for joining the show, sir.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. What impact does the lack of a sense of security in public have on the society and the economy?
It can have a very, very serious and negative impact. Obviously, if people don't feel secure, they will curtail their activities, for example. They will not participate as much in the life of the city, which also means spending money, for example, going shopping, going to the theater, to the movies, to a restaurant, meeting with friends, participating in concerts, or also taking part in community activities. So people retrench to the places that they consider safe, venture out only if absolutely needed.
Many thanks, Mr. Viano. We'll hear more of your insight later on in the program.
The surge in violence comes amid the coronavirus pandemic, which has affected the everyday lives of average Americans. With the economy strained under the weight of the pandemic, a rise in poverty translates naturally to an increase in crime rates. The rise in shooting corresponds with an increase in gun sales, which jumped at the outset of the coronavirus pandemic as stay-at-home orders unleashed a wave of unemployment across America. FBI background checks, which are conducted when a person attempts to buy a firearm from most dealers, can serve as a proxy for gun sales. In the 13 months since March of 2020, the FBI has seen 3 million background checks in a month at least 11 times, after having just one such month between 1998 and February of 2020. Experts say that while gun sale increases in previous years were related to personal safety fears or tighter gun laws, the current spike is related to worries unique to the coronavirus pandemic.
the loss of jobs, the loss of people's source of income, of their stability, of their home, of just a sense of crisis that they're in. We've seen a dramatic increase, historic increase, in the number of gun sales.
Like in many U.S. cities, COVID-19 has led to police staffing shortages and handcuffed efforts to target violence.
We're not having meetings, social interactions, and engagements that we would normally have to help stem this. We've had more than 800 of our personnel that have come down with the COVID virus. We have two that we have lost, two of our employees, one an officer and one a detention officer. So we know firsthand the impact of this pandemic.
While there have not been too many highlighted mass shootings, daily gun violence has seen a conspicuous uptick since the pandemic, which is causing concerns among families halfway through the year 2021. The coronavirus pandemic has indeed worsened the economic situation for many who find themselves having no option but to resort to crimes. We're now joined by Matthew Fogg, retired Chief Deputy Marshal, with 32 years of experience in public service. Welcome to the show, Mr. Fogg.
Good to be with you.
Many thanks. So let me ask you this. How safe are America's streets given the frequency of crime across the country?
Well, when you talk about urban areas, it's a challenge. I mean, bottom line is, I mean, your numbers are up where you've got these gun violence, but at the same time, I mean, people are living their lives. People have to go to work. People have to get on the streets, and law-abiding citizens have to do their job. So, again, you got this uptake in gun violence, mainly because law enforcement isn't out there the way it used to be. So there's a problem right there, because right now you've got this issue in America where a lot of law enforcement feels like they've been thrown under the bus because they've been exposed by a lot of the stuff that they've been doing that wasn't according to our training and what we're supposed to do.
Thank you, Mr. Fogg. We'll hear more of your insight later on in the program.
Most politicians are either ignoring the situation or trying to use the dreadful gun violence statistics to score political points against their opponents. As with any other phenomena in America, lack of safety is turning into a power play between liberals and conservatives.
Let us, the resources that we have, let them spend it. Let us spend it in a way that gives the most protection to the American people, protection for their safety, protection for their rights. The funding of police is a local matter, as you know. From the standpoint of our legislation, we're not going to that place. What we're doing is talking about how we change policy to make our policing more just and that. There's some issues that we ask police to do, like mental health issues or policing in schools and all the rest, that perhaps we can shuffle some of that money around. But those are local decisions. We take an oath to protect and defend the American people. Their safety is our top priority.
Republicans are mostly taking advantage of the situation by pointing the finger of blame at Democrats and cities under their control. They also keep bringing up the progressive idea of defunding the police to argue that the surge in violence is the fault of socialists and leftists.
Well, I mean, I just think that what's happening is the cat's out the bag, so to speak. I mean, America is a country where we believe in, the right to bear arms. And that's always been an issue when it comes down to the National Rifle Association, American Life. People want to bear arms. Now you've got more guns on American streets than you've got enough guns to give every woman, man, child, and boy a gun and still have a surplus. So you got a lot of guns out there. Then you've got this so-called war on drugs, this prohibition, which doesn't work. It's just like when they had alcohol prohibition, it never worked. They understood that and they got rid of it. They need to do the same thing with drug prohibition, because people are going to get drugs. And the United States is one of the largest supply and demand places for drugs. So you're going to have the fact that it's illegal to sell, and mostly now they use most drugs and it's illegal. We talk about Controlled Substance Act.
Meanwhile, the Democrats, who enjoy power not just at the White House but both chambers of Congress, are not doing enough to address the issue. This is creating a wide range of crime victims from all walks of life.
Again, respectful of those in law enforcement who take pride in their work, disrespectful of those who do not. we want to work together as to how we go forward.
Defunding the police has already had its costs for law enforcement. After some Democrats pursued the idea in New York City, City Council snatched $1 billion from the NYPD budget and disbanded its undercover anti-crime unit. Some cities and towns silently slashed police funds as outrage rose across the country over police brutality in the wake of the George Floyd killing.
Well, certainly that certain types of crimes have been increasing, even in so-called good neighborhoods. For example, in the neighborhood where I live, which is a very good neighborhood, it is said that at night there are people going through the neighborhood, trying cars to see if the doors are unlocked, or trying to unlock them, to either steal the cars or steal items in the cars, or taking advantage maybe in the summer of people leaving doors or windows open to commit burglaries. This is in part due to the economic situation that many people are faced with. After all, many people deemed non-essential workers have been let go, have been told we don't need you, and so go home and wait until the situation changes. But this also means that they don't have an income. In that respect, the government here in the U.S. has tried to help out with sending basically a certain amount of money to families, to citizens during this period of difficulty, or providing money to the employers with the condition that they would still pay the salary of their workers even though they were not at work. So they tried, but still, it is not the same thing as having an economy functioning well.
The U.S. police is notorious for brutality against protesters and racial minorities. However, pressure on law enforcement to cause less trouble for the government could actually have played a part in the recent surge in violence.
I'll still be at work, and they'll be back at the precinct picking up their property before I'm even done with court.
Really?
Yeah.
That's got to be frustrating.
Yeah.
And it sucks to see this, to see 16-year-old kids shooting and killing each other. And that's what we do see a lot of here. And we have 16-year-olds with robbery patterns and murder charges, and it's like they didn't actually get to be kids.
After all, defunding the police was a progressive idea that popped up in the heat of the 2020 presidential election. Although it was later dismissed by the more central Democrats, such as now President Biden. Whether or not the Republicans' talking point has anything to do with the situation today, generations of Americans have fallen victim to violence running rampant in the country all throughout its history. Where are the communities heading in their struggle with gun violence in more dangerous places such as Chicago?
There is no question that Chicago has a very high level of violence. And we have to make a comment, which is very important, that the increase in violence recently in American cities, and I'm sure not only in the United States, is due to a perfect storm of factors. There has been an economic collapse because many businesses closed down, didn't have any income, they have to let their employees go, they didn't have any customers. Think of the restaurants, the hotels, tourism, transportation, and so on and so forth. So the economic collapse, the social anxiety because of the pandemic, the fear that people had of each other, in a sense, as someone being a transmitter of the disease. Also, crisis in policing in major cities after incidents brought to light recently of encounters between police and mostly minority members.
Many experts point out that overall crime rates have fallen compared to the past decade. However, trust in police has eroded after incidents like the murder of African-American George Floyd by a white police officer, weakening any incentives for the people to cooperate with law enforcement.
Now you can see the car is being rotated. You're able to see
Officer Chauvin, here I see Officer King, and then Officer Lane down at his feet. You see underneath Mr. Floyd, and now the car has been rotated, now the car has been removed. And so you're able to see how they're positioned at different points. In terms of with Officer Chauvin with his left knee on the neck, his right knee on Mr. Floyd's arm and chest, and then you can see here Officer Lane holding his legs, and then you can see Officer King with his knee on his torso.
After a video of George Floyd dying under the knee of a Minneapolis police officer was released, the nation rose up to slam violence against people of color in police departments. To this day, the legitimacy of the American police remains in question alongside the sharp rise in crime.
One issue that we have to deal with in the U.S. is the issue of guns. There is no question that too many people have firearms and that they can be used to commit crimes. They can be used in confrontations, in domestic violence, and so on and so forth. And this is very often a situation where there are lots of shootings in many cities. At times during a weekend, you might have 18, 20, even more dead people in Chicago or in a major city because of fights, disagreement, confrontations, robberies that go wrong, and so on and so forth.
The U.S. criminal justice system has played its role in the new crime wave, particularly with reforms designed to reduce the population of prisoners, according to some experts. The pervasive gang culture in America is yet another factor contributing to the increase in gun violence.
I was born and raised around here. I've lived on just about every block from Congress on down to Madison.
You're really part of this neighborhood.
I am a part of this neighborhood. I am a product of this neighborhood. Around here, I was a gang member. I was their queen. I was considered the big hat. I was a gang chief, which is why I love being assigned to this area because I get to give back to the community. I get to rebuild some of the things that I helped tear down.
Regaining the public trust is probably the single most important task the authorities need to achieve in order to make America's streets safe. This way, they might be able to compensate for a reduction in police funds in some communities. How do you think the Biden administration should approach the issue of safety and gun violence in America? How do you evaluate the Biden administration's performance so far?
He's already has addressed the issue, saying that they're going to send more federal troops or federal agents into the urban cities, into the places where gun violence is up. I applaud that. You got to have law enforcement out there. Those people out there that are committing these acts need to know that there will be some type of punishment, and so we swift punishment if they are out there using guns. So you got to have more people, more law enforcement focusing on that area, and the people on the street have to know that they're there. So and the Biden administration has said that that's what they're asking cities and saying, we want to come in and we want to help. So I give them an A on that. The reality is he stepped into something, though, that's already in place. It's the ball, as they say, the wheel is already rolling. So it's a challenging, very challenging for law enforcement, because right now, again, when you're talking about the war on drugs, you're talking about drugs on the street. We got pounds and pounds, millions of pounds of drugs on the street, and people are trying to survive. So people are going to sell them. The problem is when people feel like they have been wronged, then they take the law in their own hands, and that means if you go out and you kill somebody or shoot somebody or whatever, the bottom line is to make certain that you get your drugs are not interfered with. So you've got all of that going on at the same time.
Sadly, committing homicide and murder is easier than ever in the United States, with its lax gun laws providing easy access to guns for most people. Gun violence, murders, and gang activities all involve getting hold of guns, which is easier than ever before.
But there are several factors at play, and And the data showing these numbers rising in cities across the country is troubling, not only for law enforcement officials, but it's something that community leaders are having to grapple with on a daily basis. And you see it in many of our big cities across the country, the kind of violence that makes it in the headlines, not only in the papers, but obviously on TV as well. And so after years of declines and dramatic declines in the crime numbers across this country in many of the big cities, what you are seeing now and what you've been seeing over the last couple of years is a reverse of that. You see the numbers really going up, and that is what we're seeing consistently now into 2021 as well.
Thousands of people die every year from gun violence as more people keep hoarding more and more firearms. The gun business in the U.S. is controlled by powerful lobbies who won't allow gun control laws to pass against their profits. From professional criminals to normal people beside themselves, guns could provide the illusion of a go-to solution to deal with the conflict at hand.
The lack of security is always a concern, because if you don't have security, then you just never know what kind of, who's going to create what kind of nefarious act, and people can be hurt. So when you talk about public safety, you have to have security first. So reality is that if we're not secure in any place, any building, any location, security is always your number one priority when you're in law enforcement and you're trying to make certain that people, you know, we just got people in this world that want to do nefarious things and break the laws and so forth. So you just have to have security. So that's essential. That's number one when you're talking about law enforcement and how we do our operations.
The heaviest burden of daily gun violence is at communities of color, cities such as Philadelphia, St. Louis, Chicago, and Oakland. The latest crime wave is heightening pressure on President Biden to make investment in preventing inner-city gun violence, focused primarily on black and brown communities.
I have kids growing up in this world. I got three beautiful children. They're mixed, but even though they're mixed, they look like me. They look the same, and it could have easily been them. It could have easily been me.
Michael Holliday came here from Houston, where Floyd grew up.
Imagine if it was your child. How would you feel? Imagine if it was your son on the ground screaming, "I can't breathe. Help me. Please." This community already knows his name, but the world needs to hear his name. So until we have justice, there will be no peace.
The president has come under attack for trying to hire more police force above pre-pandemic levels. That has caused backlash from African-American movements, some describing it as a slap in the face of millions of them who came out in support of Biden in the 2020 presidential race. Whether or not crime will lessen under the Biden administration remains to be seen. I'm your host, Mila Javamardi. Be sure to tune in next week when we come back with another episode of We the People.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
At least 915 shootings in a single week leaves 430 dead and 1,007 wounded, with the U.S. on track for its deadliest year of gun violence, says Rachel Sharp, reporter, in an article titled U.S. Records One Shooting Every 12 Minutes. Stay tuned for more. The United States of America has recorded one shooting every 12 minutes recently, with at least 915 incidents leaving 430 dead and 1,007 wounded as gun violence spirals out of control across the nation. Data from the nonprofit Gun Violence Archive reveals more than 1,000 Americans were wounded or killed in shootings in the 7 days between Saturday, July 17th, and Friday, July 23rd. The shootings of the last week comes as the nation is on track to record its deadliest year of gun violence to date. Between January and July 24th, 2021, there has been 25,216 gun-related deaths, including homicides, murders, suicides, unintentional shootings, and defensive gun use incidents. On average, this means 123 people have died every single day in 2021. If the trend continues, almost 45,000 people will lose their lives to gun violence by the end of the year. This figure dwarfs the 43,563 shooting deaths recorded in 2020, which had been the deadliest year for shooting incidents in at least two decades. Gun violence rocked almost every state recently, with at least one gun-related incident recorded in 47 states and the District of Columbia, according to ABC News analysis of GVA data. Illinois recorded the most shootings with 109 incidents in the last week. One shooting recently saw a 14-year-old boy killed and nine others injured in two shootings on the west side of Chicago. Five people were shot in the first shooting in the North Landale section, with five more shot in a second shooting three blocks away less than 5 minutes later. Gun violence has plagued the Windy City in 2021, with the city's crime data showing a 9% jump in shootings so far compared to the same time last year and a 60% jump from 2019. During the July 4th weekend alone, 92 people were shot in the city and 16 were killed. After Illinois, Texas recorded the highest number of shootings last week, with 63 incidents, including a drive-by shooting in Houston that killed one man and injured five others. Pennsylvania was next with 59 shootings, including one shocking incident, where a one-year-old girl was shot inside a convenience store in Philadelphia on July 17th. The infant was caught in the crossfire as people opened fire both inside and outside the store. She is expected to survive. In another incident, a Philadelphia Eagles fan was arrested for allegedly shooting and killing a New York Giants fan during an argument about football while in line for chess steaks at iconic Pat's King of Steaks eatery. California and New York also recorded high numbers of shootings, with 52 and 48 incidents each in the last week. Governor Andrew Cuomo has described gun violence as a major civil rights issue and announced the state will offer 4,000 summer jobs and full-time jobs with training for the city's youth in the hopes of providing an alternative to gun violence. Cuomo admitted back in May that New York City is now in the throes of a major problem. New York City in particular has been rocked by a crime wave this year, with shootings spiking 21.9% in 2021 compared to last year as of July 18th. There are also 16% more shooting victims this year, the data shows, with 981 people falling prey to gun violence compared to 846 last year. Meanwhile, violence erupted in downtown Milwaukee recently, with three people wounded in two separate shootings as thousands of fans celebrated the Bucks' first NBA championship in 50 years. Over in Seattle, three people were killed and five injured in a series of shootings, all within a three-hour period. In Vasco, California, a sheriff's deputy was shot and killed and two of his colleagues injured in a shooting at home following a standoff with a suspect recently. Kern County Deputy Philip Campos, a father to two young girls and former soldier in the United States Marine Corps, was killed in the line of duty when deputies were called to a residence in Kern County to reports of shots fired. When officers arrived on the scene, the suspect began shooting at them and hours-long standoff ensued. The suspect fired shots at officers again around 2 hours later, striking the three cops. Of the more than 25,000 shooting deaths so far this year, 11,554 were homicides, murders, unintentional shootings, and defensive gun use incidents, with the other 13,662 suicides. The nation has been rocked by a spate of mass shootings this year, with 389 recorded up to July 2014. Back in March, Robert Aaron Long, 21, allegedly killed eight people, six of them Asian women, in a series of attacks at three Atlanta spas. Just over the week, gunman Alisa allegedly shot dead 10 people, including a police officer, in a supermarket in Boulder, Colorado. In May, eight people were shot and killed at a FedEx ground facility in Indiana. Police. Children haven't been spared from the nation's skyrocketing gun violence, with 176 kids up to age 11 killed as a result of shootings so far this year. Another 451 have been injured, while the figures are even worse among teenagers. A total of 1,896 children aged 12 to 17 have been injured, and 713 killed through to July 24th. Members of law enforcement are also among the victims of the surge in gun crime, with 33 killed and 193 injured as of July 24th. Shooting deaths have been climbing overall since 2014, rising from 33,804 that year to almost 44,000 in 2020. But the last year took a particularly steep climb amid the pandemic. In light of the spike in gun violence, Joe Biden unveiled a series of executive actions designed to curb gun violence following the shootings. The six actions include a crackdown on the proliferation of ghost guns, which are built from kits, or tightening requirements on pistol braces that allow for more accurate shooting. Biden said mass shootings are a public health crisis and argued he was not trying to impinge on the Second Amendment, a claim gun rights groups and Republicans have made against the introduction of gun control laws.
industry.
It is being called the story of the year. An Israeli spying company has been caught selling software to authoritarian regimes that have used it to surveil more than 50,000 people worldwide. That company is NSO, founded in 2010 by former members of Unit 8200, the Israeli military's notorious intelligence squad. Their product is called Pegasus, and it was sold to military, law enforcement, and intelligence agencies in 40 countries, among them some of the world's worst human rights abusing governments. Pegasus is able to attack the cell phones of targeted individuals without them realizing it, monitoring and recording their calls, texts, and accessing other information stored on their devices. Dozens of human rights activists, nearly 200 journalists, several Arab royals, and more than 600 politicians are known to have had their communications spied on and compromised. Among those include French President Emmanuel Macron, Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan, and President of Iraq, Barham Saleh. It gets juicier. Close associates of the Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi were also attacked and compromised just before his murder by Saudi operatives in 2018, strongly indicating that the information gleaned through Pegasus was crucial in his murder. NSO vehemently denied that their product was used in the assassination. Yet it also put out a statement insisting that it had no access to what its clients did with the software, two seemingly contradicting assertions here. Among those who had their communications and devices spied on by Pegasus were journalists, human rights activists, business executives, academics, and prominent political leaders. The NSO group and its Pegasus software is clearly a major scandal that deserves scrutiny. However, the treatment of the incident by the media has largely absolved the Israeli government of any role in that affair, despite the fact that the NSO group's sales of Pegasus to foreign governments has been approved and defended by Israel's government. This, of course, means that Israel's government has obvious responsibility in the whole scandal as well. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Accusations that spy software known as Pegasus may have been used to carry out surveillance on journalists, activists, and even kings, presidents, and political leaders highlights that surveillance is now for sale. Guess who's selling? Israel. The ability to remotely access phones was once considered something only a few states could do. But high-end espionage and surveillance powers, when in the hands of a rogue entity like Israel, can easily turn into a commercialized weapon that breaches personal privacy in a fraudulent access to personal electronic devices, which would definitely lead to criminal association. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Hassan Yunus, author, expert in international business management. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Hassan. Now, the Israeli spyware is a breach of personal privacy and a fraudulent access to personal electronic devices. Most alarming is the freedom of expression and freedom of speech here for the journalists, which is basically the foundation of their work. It is being jeopardized by such spyware and malware. Now, the consequences of this is critical, and it might lead to criminal act, hint the Khashoggi case, for example. Do you think this scandal will finally expose Israel's espionage role all over the world, or maybe just another anti-Semitism card will be played?
Thanks a lot for hosting me, Marwa. It gives me pleasure to be on your show. This spyware has been implemented in a very rude way, and all the documents show that. It leverages cutting-edge technology, unique technology. A lot of research and development was invested in this spyware. Definitely it's a great violation of human rights, and this is a violation of the Article 19, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the International Human Rights Law, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. That's why it's being more rude than ever before. especially when you do this kind of espionage. Actually, in business and in politics, we can do kind of due diligence on our opponents, on our rivals. Yet, when it's used in an unethical manner, it becomes espionage. In business, we talk about industrial espionage. In politics, we talk about this kind of crisis. And you start connecting the dots and start linking the information which was leaked from those who were under attack. Literally, it's an attack. To many of the incidents which have come, many of which are which have happened, many of which were criminal incidents. So when you talk about Israel, for example, the nature of business of Israel, the nature of what they do is a criminal. So when you want to develop this multi-billion dollar spyware, then you'll use it on your supply chain, on the activities which you do, whether upstream activities, downstream activities, it depends. But it has to be linked to some kinds of criminal activities, whether through you or through some of your partners in the region, locally, internationally. It depends on the target which you want to achieve.
Well, Dr. Hassan, this spyware was developed with cutting-edge technology, as you just mentioned, which basically requires massive investments, research, and development activity. This requires state interventions, maybe consortium organizations to contribute to this spyware. How much does that mean that the U.S. and the U.K. government were actually on board from the beginning?
Yeah. Actually, this spyware leverages the power of the fourth industrial revolution, which is social, mobile, analytics, and the cloud. It requires the cloud computing. It requires giving access to this kind of cloud to do the computing. It requires huge power to do the analytics of big data, in addition to social and mobile, which are the two components of the fourth industrial revolution. This requires major investments, huge investments, which individual companies can't afford, which a consortium by itself can't afford. It requires consortia, probably, and definitely of superpowers. Superpowers, it's not a secret that the U.S. And the U.K. can be part of this consortium, because they are in very strong ties with Israel. They have alliances on several fronts. So when it comes to this technology, which is usually exported from the West to our region, then the US and the UK should have a say and should have an investment in research and development. Not any nation has this access to research and development. It is in the hands of few top powers, where the Silicon Valley is, where the leading softwares are. So definitely the US and the UK have a hand, and I don't think it's a secret, so I don't think that they are trying to hide this. It's very apparent to everyone.
Well, the leaks raised several concerns and prompted international bodies to condemn these operations. Now, Lebanon, our country, was not immune from this spyware, where attempts have been made to eavesdrop on about 300 phone numbers in Lebanon by the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, which reveals the extent of the role of Saudi Arabia in preoccupation, basically, in Lebanon's affairs, despite the fact they keep saying it's none of our business. It specifically culminates in the case of former Prime Minister Saad al-Hariri, and as his phone was subjected to surveillance by said state. I mean, why would such an Arab regime be spying on their own asset to begin with in a country like Lebanon?
Because we are part of the business of these countries. So when we talk about the Lebanese politics, we have never been the decision makers in Lebanon. We receive the decisions from the superpowers. The superpowers can be the USA, Russia, UK, any superpower at the international level, using some of their tools in the region. These tools can be some of the regimes in the region, and we know the rivalry between between the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the ex-Prime Minister Saad Hariri. Not a rivalry, we know the state of dislike, if I don't want to exaggerate. They don't want him to be the Prime Minister. It was apparent, otherwise he would have been the elected president. Many people talk about kind of personal conflicts between MBS and Saad Hariri. So this might have led to the espionage or the surveillance on his phone because they want access to his personal data because he's no more trustworthy. He's not trusted by the regional powers, especially by Saudi Arabia.
That's a very funny way of them showing that they care by actually tapping into his phone. But it is noteworthy that the two of the relatives of a Saudi journalist, the murdered Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who was killed in Istanbul in 2018, has been included in the leaked list of phone numbers targeted by this spyware, by Pegasus. This makes Israel complicit, by the way, with the regime of Mohammed bin Salman and the murder, and makes way for more crimes that occurred because of this software. What options do you think international bodies have to deal with this critical issue? And maybe the best question to ask is, do they have enough power to stop the Israeli exported espionage?
Yeah. Actually, I'm not here to comment on the political aspect of what happened with Khashoggi or with Allah in the UAE or with Mansour or many other names. Definitely, the judicial bodies and the journalists will do these connection of the dots. And I think when you connect the dots, when you put the different independent variables into the formula, you can come up with some critical conclusions, because this is the story of the year, as Edward Snowden has named it. Definitely, it requires. And I've read a lot of condemnation, if I can say, by the universal. By people saying that it's this is a violation of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the international human rights law, the laws on civil and political rights. Many journalism associations worldwide have condemned this rude spyware, as I've said, because it's not any spyware. When Israel develops this spyware, uses its relationship with the top industrialized nations in the world, invests a lot in this bleeding-edge technology, not only cutting-edge, it's a bleeding-edge technology, and the nature of the business of Israel has a criminal aspect, then this requires not only condemning it, but going a bit further than that, because it's a violation of our basic rights of freedom of expression. It's
and
invasion of our
basically.
Privacy. If my privacy is being invaded, then I will not feel free to express my opinions,
definitely.
Whether political or not political.
Definitely.
So.
Such
invasion
a pleasure,
of privacy.
Hassan Yunus,
it's my utmost pleasure, actually.
To discuss Pegasus and how it can affect everyone's lives, basically. Dr. Hassan Yunus, author and expert in international business management, thank you very much for your time, for being with us to discuss this. Now, please stay tuned, because we will next be talking about TOCA.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Now, the abuse of Pegasus software has been known for several years. Though the latest revelations appeared to have gained such traction in the mainstream media owing to the high number of civilians who have reportedly been surveilled through its use. The continuation of the now years-long scandal surrounding the abuse of Pegasus has also brought considerable controversy and notoriety to the Israeli company that developed it, the NSO Group. While the NSO Group has become infamous, other Israeli companies with even deeper ties to Israel's intelligence apparatus have been selling software that not only provides the exact same services to governments, to intelligence agencies, but purports to go even farther than that. Come along, meet TOCA.